There's been a big interest in the Orient since World War II, I guess.
Don't you wait? You push a button. It's already pushed.
Already pushed. Okay.
In my own area, on the part of artists, because of the introduction of Zen and Kung Fu on TV, I have some suspicions about the depth of relationship between some contemporary art in the West and Zen Buddhism, but there are some things there of similarity. And a lot of scholars have been trying to keep up with what's happening behind the so-called bamboo curtain, and of course Nixon's trip brought to public view, I suspect, more than anything else since the end of World War II, the possibility of there being real people in China. A number of universities and colleges have introduced programs of studies. We're having a hard time funding them, which is amazing to me, since we're excluding at least a third of the world from many of our studies. And it is almost an academic sin that all universities do not have a fat program in Asian materials. I would, if I had the power and the glory, I would make it a requirement that all students get involved with a course in Oriental materials. I wouldn't care what it was, literature, philosophy, art, history, or the study of Eastern religions. It just would seem that there are problems for us ahead if we ignore that. But it's not only just problems, because there's another major reason to get involved with Oriental art and the Oriental world, and that is simply the intrinsic value. There's some magnificent stuff, alien in many respects to our own experience, but joyful, handsome, long tradition, much longer tradition than most of us realize, and a much longer tradition than is present in most of our art forms in the West. We will be starting, and I'll show you a piece that is dated about 1500 BC. Now, 1500 BC in the West is equal to the age of the Minotaur, King Minos, on the island of Crete, Agamemnon. It's even 400 years before the Trojan War, which some people don't buy yet as a historical event. So, there are a number of reasons why we ought to spend time looking at the East. I'm going to restrict my comments to East Asia, a couple of things about Japan and China. This is not my field of expertise. I had a Fulbright to Taiwan about 10 or 12 years ago, and got from that came my main interest, and I teach courses now and then in Oriental art, but it's not my my main field. I want to talk about the intrinsic values probably a little bit more than the extrinsic ones. The extrinsic ones, of course, are valuable because we have been discovering, particularly in the United States in the last few years, that not only is the Western way not the only way, it might not even be the best way. And I'm talking here in terms of economics and politics, relationship of man to nature. I want to spend most of the time this morning on therefore some of the intrinsic ones, but I want to lay out some comparisons and some ideas behind the images. It's very easy for us to get hung up on Oriental art for reasons of style. For example, we look at the color, we look at the shape, we can look at what's happened to the material through age, as we do even in the West, and get all excited about things which are kind of phony. We look at the great beautiful marbles coming from the Parthenon, and we get all excited, as Michelangelo did, about the purity of the stone. Well, that's all right, except that that's false if you're trying to get an idea about antiquity, because we know that all the marbles on the Parthenon are either painted or stained. All of Greek art is painted or stained, but it's all worn off. We don't know about that. Michelangelo didn't know about it, so we've been hung up for the last 5 years on the truth to material, and has given us a phony view of ancient times. We do similarly get a phony view if we restrict ourselves to the surface of Oriental art. So I hope to get behind the surface a little bit and talk about the meanings or the ideas behind some of the images. Perhaps, and I don't discount this as a value, we will be looking at a new kind of taste for some of us. But we ought to be aware of the fact that taste changes. And I give you a couple of examples here. These are two artists who in their own time were not particularly accepted for what you see on the screen.
Dale?
Yes. Where can I get to make
a photo?
The reason I'm doing this in here instead of the center is I hope that we'll have some discussion or comments or questions or what the heck is that or what did you say, notions coming from you rather than a straight lecture. And I can't do that in the center very well because you're all lined up looking at the, well, you're doing that here too, sort of the back of each other's heads. But I think we have a better chance of discussion here. El Greco on the left is much admired today, similarly Rembrandt. And they've had ups and downs in the history of art in terms of their popularity. But we ought to recognize that at one time the material on the left was illegible, non-understandable, unappreciated, and even kind of ignored until times changed. People got back on the frequency that El Greco was on. Rembrandt, when he arrived at the late period of his life, was running out of money and had to incorporate himself, literally, in order to keep from going to debtor's prison. And so every time he sold a painting, three guys would jump on him and take all the money. And he didn't have enough money even to buy pigment. So his son and a friend incorporated him so that they could capture some of that money to make to allow Rembrandt to live. The point of this is, what you're looking at on the right, which we now admire and respect here in the latter part of the 20th century, El Greco's great expressionist canvases of 17th century Spain, which we admire. Remember, we admire them in part, individually, because they seem to be attuned with what we like today. 75 years ago, they were not what we liked, and therefore they were not admired. I want you to be aware of that as you look at some of the Oriental material, that it's very different, and it can be admired, but remember that it can be admired sometimes, maybe not for wrong reasons, but don't make the reasons that you like it be the only reasons that you might find some value in. And I want to spend time making comparisons and contrasts now between the art of the East and the West. The reason for the comparisons, of course, is that we need something to hang on to. They have to relate our own perspective of the world from where we are, part of Carol's Bible study this morning was today. You cannot relate to yesterday or tomorrow. You've got to relate to where you are today. And therefore, where you are today will be easier if I make some comparisons. On the other hand, we can enlarge our perspective with new experiences if we make some contrasts. And essentially, then, that's what I'll be doing, making both the comparison and the contrast. They're both essential. And the primary purpose of this is to allow you to shift gears. Because you must have a certain kind of consciousness about the shifting of gears as you get involved with the Oriental image. Well, what do we compare and what do we contrast? Let's start in the area of aesthetics. Most of what I'm going to say is going to be related to the elements of understanding an aesthetic system of the East or the West. Right away, I have a major problem, though, because for the West, we define aesthetics as a way of identifying or being involved with or experiencing what we call the beautiful, leaving that definition alone. It comes from the Greek word which refers to perception of the senses, and it is to be distinguished. That is, you like a color, you like a taste, you enjoy a sound or a tactile sensation, sensorily. and has nothing to do with morals. Absolutely nothing. This is an attempt to help us understand what makes a work of art tick and us tick if we separate aesthetics then from morals. And the West has been comfortable with that, and there's been a number of systems. But boy, for the East, we have a monumental problem. Let me read one paragraph. Any work of art is in its essence a phase of inner life immortalized in the form of beauty, truth, and moral excellence. And the lack of any one of these elements renders it imperfect. It requires a painter of exceptional talent and consummate skill to achieve their integration in a form in which the rhythm of life and spirit finds the highest expression, failing which art becomes merely a graphic representation of nature and man destitute of life and spirit. Realizing this, the bona fide artist is therefore ever in pursuit of the threefold perfection of art in terms of beauty, truth, and moral excellence. Now, we wouldn't say that in the West if we were talking about aesthetics. That quote, by the way, is from Madame Chiang Kai-shek, who got her education in Wellesley. I think she's a Wellesley graduate. But it is, and she herself is an artist, and it's a fairly accurate statement of the Oriental understanding of their art, that moral excellence is always to be wrapped up with the essence of a work of art. I mentioned that we have a lot of systems in the West about aesthetics and understanding what makes a work of art tick, how we respond to it, what makes us tick to it. The Orientals seem not to have a system. They've not been interested in creating a system or in systems of aesthetics. They seem not to have been interested in systematizing their ideas about art in an attempt to understand either the philosophy of the art or the psychology of it. As an example of this, one group of Oriental philosophers about 300 BC called the Neo-Mohists, they came about as close as any Eastern philosophers that I know of to create a system. And they omitted from knowledge any experience which could not be conceptualized. Well, that automatically omits from knowledge what we call the aesthetic experience. That is, they would not allow the aesthetic experience to be a form of knowledge. That is, the excitement, the richness, the joy, these kinds of receptions of sensory information and how we respond to it, they do not allow that to be knowledge. The majority of Oriental writers on the subject present similar views to, for example, the following. This is a quote about a contemporary painter on Taiwan. Mr. Chang has roots lying deep in the Chinese classical tradition, but his fruits are pleasingly fresh and original. His compositions, whether simple or complex, are characterized by a sense of balance and clarity, which imparts the feeling that he knows exactly what ideas he has in mind, what mood he wishes to impart, rhythmic vitality, artistry, power, etc., etc., etc. Now, many Western writers sound the same, and in general, we don't buy some of these remarks as having any value, because although they might be true, there's no real attempt to pin anything down. He talks about a sense of balance and a sense of clarity, compositions with a simple or complex. What does that mean? I believe it's true, but I need to have more specificity in order to have that be valuable to me. I can't use that comment about Mr. Cheng's paintings because it's too sticky. Now, in the West, we have spent a lot of time, a lot of books, a lot of articles, a lot of discussions, trying to pin down more specific. But in the East, there is none of that. One of the clues to this might be found, and some of you might have the same trouble in trying to understand Carradine in the person of the hero in Kung Fu. One of the clues might be in language. The Oriental language. Now, the structure and the nature of the Chinese language, particularly the Chinese I'm talking about, the only thing I really know about, is a sufficiently fascinating topic that we could spend a whole evening. And somebody pinned out, you were telling me, there's a young man here on the staff who spent 10 years in Hong Kong. Is he in the room? He ought to be. He's in the kitchen. He could help me here. But let me give you about 30 seconds on the Oriental language to maybe give you an input to the rest of the morning. The language is very old. It has a history perhaps beginning around 1000 BC. And the language includes in their writing every form of literature that we have in the West, with the exception perhaps of the epic. Our literature, we sort of think of beginning with the epic. We think of Homer. In a great sense, some of the great Old Testament statements have epical proportions. But the epic itself seems not to be a part of Eastern writing. Poetry is the extreme achievement. Now, as early as the 7th century, they were printing and invented movable type in China. That's, 700 years before it came to Europe. At first, the Chinese language started with some very simple pictographs. Let me draw a couple on the board. A lot of languages have begun with that. That meant the sun. That meant the moon. That meant the mountain, obviously. Modern characters developed from that. This is not the way the Chinese writing appears today, but they came from this. It is pictographs. It actually looked like the sun, or the moon, or mountains. The modern Chinese character for mountain, for example, is that. And you can see its relationship. The modern Chinese character for moon is something like that. That's a cross line, no doubt. And then they developed compounds. For example, that's a roof. And it looks like a thatched roof in, we do a little bit of drawing in here. You see a thatched roof on with a pole holding it up in the villages. And that's a woman. And you can see character here. Perhaps she's a pregnant woman. Arms comes down from her head. What happens if you put a woman under a roof? Well, if you take these two and compound them, woman under a roof, this means peace. Now, this is the way their language developed. And you can see that you've got a very different development from our language today. And if you have to get involved with this kind of imagery to do the reading, you can see why we have great problems. The Chinese typewriter, for example, today has something like, or the Chinese newspaper has something like 7,000 characters. And a Chinese typewriter, I saw one, huge, long thing. And instead of keys with all these hundreds and hundreds of characters, they had an arm that you'd pick up and go over and pick up a type and come down, put it down, and then pick it up like that. So you can imagine it would take, as Jack said, all night to paint, to draw, or not all night to type up two or three paragraphs. Now, relevant to our problem, though, is that in terms of language, and I'm trying to hook this on to why they maybe don't have a system of aesthetics, the critical, tight, precise way of talking in print about art. All the characters are monosyllabic, and the language is totally non-inflected. There's no gender, there's no case, there's no number, there's no past tense, no future tense. There, when you put a bunch of characters together, you can get 3 or 4 or 5 or 20 different translations. Not that anybody misinterprets what the characters are, but you don't know if that's moon or moons, or of the moon or to the moon or with the moon, or moon. It's totally uninflected. Therefore, what really tells you what the sentence is all about is the position of the character in relationship to others, and even this can be interpreted differently. Now, keep this in mind. Therefore, we do not have the possibility of a kind of unified structure. I can say the cat, or Odin is looking at the squirrel. If I were to put that in Chinese characters, you might get all kinds of things, including the squirrels chasing or looking at Odin, which changes the whole character of what I wanted to say. Now, if your language process is this, then and they're opposed to anything that is identifiable in terms of a precise structure or system for aesthetics, then when they begin to work on art, to create works of art, they're going to have some of the same elements. For example, one of the characteristic formats of the West is a painting. You've got a frame around it. They hang it on a wall. For the Orient, one of the major formats of painting is a scroll. Well, not only can I not hang it on a wall or put a frame along it, you know, it might be 25 feet long. It's meant to be seen a foot at a time by one or two people. Not up on a wall where everybody can look at it. It becomes more private. And right away we get, therefore, one of the clues I think is important about Oriental art, and that is its sense of private participation, perhaps involved with the fact that the scroll at one time was a dominant form. The scroll is simply not a public work of art. Now, this is not restrictive in the sense, because there's no inflection, no singular, no plural, no tenses, etc. It's not restrictive. The problem is probably it's not restrictive enough, so that you have tremendous latitude for trying to understand. And you hear those things that come through in Kung Fu, and they say them, and my son is sitting there watching it, and I'm sitting there watching it, and then we talk about what was said, and we get different things. The point is not that one of us is right. The point is that there's a possibility for individual participation in whatever the Kung Fu expression was. But see how it makes it difficult to put that into a system and to talk about it and label it, characterize it. Somebody say something?
No, they just came in.
Oh, no, okay. There are a couple of other general differences, too, which I mentioned before we get into specifics. There's a poet in the Han Dynasty. This is the 2nd century. In this, when he was writing, 2nd century before Christ. He was a great Fu poet. The Fu, F-U, is a form of poetry. And he speaks of writers being born, not made. This is partially thought about in the West as true also, that artists are born, they're not made. You can't create artists. I think, though, it's bought more in the East than it is in the West, that artists are born and not made. We say on this, on any occasion, startling things have been happening in genetics. So maybe if I were to talk about, make that sentence in another 5 years, I'd have to qualify myself because of what we know in the field of genetics. We're finding out more. The genetic structure of Rich, if he passes it on to his son, there might be one little whirling thing down there on that whatever the DNA shape is, that makes his son be a painter of Christ figures. That's pretty tight. 20 years ago, everybody used to kind of laugh at the idea. We don't laugh at it quite so much now. At any rate, the idea that artists are born and not made puts it in a mystical position as opposed to a very specific one. Therefore, you can't train artists. And up until I went to Taiwan and Japan in 1960, boy, it's been about 12 years now, 62, 63. At that time, there was not one university in Japan that allowed the teaching of art, because it wasn't something you could teach, according to their theory. So as late as in the middle 60s, there was not a university in Japan that did not subscribe to this theory. Artists are born, not made. Therefore, you can't teach art. Well, there were artists on their own who taught, and there was some art history and archaeology, but there was no pick up the brush and the pencil and draw. Now, some of it was taught some area, but not for credit, whatever their equivalent system is. So you see that they still believe the statement that artists are born and not made. One other general difference. About 20 years ago, and this is really recent, this is in the middle 50s, a book was published on Chinese art by Mr. and Mrs. Burling, Judy and Arthur Burling. And in their preface, they said there is no comprehensive book dealing with Chinese art written by a Chinese. Now, don't misunderstand what they're saying. There are many writings by Eastern authors on art and artists, but most of them are exaltations about art or artists and not attempts to formulate theories of art. The closest thing that we have to a formula for a theory of art in the East is what's called the Mustard Seed Garden Manual of Painting. It's a 17th century book in which the author talks about six elements of correct painting. Half of the six, by the way, speaks specifically of techniques. It is how to prepare silk, how to prepare the pigment. So that isn't really a manual on aesthetics, it's really a technique of how-to. The other half are in such general terms as the writing I quoted earlier, that really it's useless for trying to base a kind of system on. They use such terms as you have to create the art with appropriateness, or you have to create the work of art with virtue. I don't dispute these. I simply say, pedagogically, that's an impossible thing to go to a student and say and stop right there. You've got to analyze it a little further. Let me be a little more specific now. Remember, we're trying to find some similarities and some differences. Let me talk again about some general... I'll get down on the floor. Some general similarities. When I first went to Italy in the 50s, I had been studying art history for about 5 years, and I was really impressed with the Italian artists, how they spent a great deal of time on creating magnificent forms of landscape. Well, what happened, of course, those of you who've been to Italy or have looked at a painter, realized that the artist didn't create the form of the landscape at all. He just had a magnificent eye. He created other things. But these trees, in the background of the deposition of the Fra Angelico painting a moment ago, these trees, these beautiful, stylized statements, that's the way some Italian trees look. So the artist, therefore, did not create it. The Chinese artist on the left, Mu Qi, who presents us a very wispy landscape, very similar to part of this morning. If you got up early this morning, you saw the cloud behind us on Martin's Ridge really cut off part of the mountain, and the mountain was suspended. There was no weight. It didn't come down to the valley floor. Well, these are kind of archetype oriental landscapes, and we think, of, wow, what a great sense of imagination, great sense of creativity. The point is, of course, that Mu Qi, like Fra Angelico, although we can talk about him as a great creative artist in many areas, some of those things we admire most, he's not a creator, he's just got a smashing eye. And he can see what happens when fog comes in and cuts off a mountain and gives us a sense of a soft quality on the paper. The main point I'm trying to get here is one of the great similarities is that artists of both persuasion, the East and the West, are what I would call profound realists, both visually and what they talk about. That's why I don't like to use the term. All artists are realists, in my point of view, because they're talking about something real, be it an expression, a moment, a fog, or a tree that looks like a pineapple. They're realists. And I think this is one similarity right away that we ought to make, that the Oriental artist, the Western artist, they are both realists. Let me make one statement of emphasis on something I mentioned earlier. It's my own particular kind of hang-up, but I like to have people aware of the fact that color is something that is very important to both the Oriental and the Western tradition. And unfortunately, I didn't bring those, so I didn't know I was going to do this thing. Color, the Egyptian artist, the Greek artist, were fantastic colorists, and we never think of them that way. And particularly in the architecture, reds, blues, flashing reds and blues, I don't mean a little tint, all the staining of the marble columns on the Acropolis, the Parthenon was stained and rubbed with wax and impurities that were allowed to rust the surface of the marble. They didn't like a pure hunk of marble. They thought it was dead and without character, so they colored it. Orientals do exactly the same. Their Buddhist temples are a shock to most of us. You walk in and violent reds, greens, and they jar. They seem garish. Now, one of the reasons they seem garish is that we have been nurtured in our own tradition of the purity of the form, purity of the material, in part as a hangover from our foundings in classical times. But if we interpreted that correctly, we would find that we had a screwed up feeling, because our interest in classical art would have given us a feeling for the rich, glorious color, the same way we would find it in the Orient. One of the major dissimilarities is in the area of illusionism, which has dominated Western art, with the exception of the time from about 550 to maybe about 1300, our Middle Ages in general. And I'll make a couple of sentences, I'll make a couple of comments throughout the morning to the fact that one of the intriguing periods of similarity in the East and the West is our Middle Ages and the general Oriental flavor. But the dissimilarities now, for example, Joyce Carey, in a nice little paperback book called Art and Reality, came out about 15, 18 years ago, I guess. He talks about a friend who had came, who had come to his studio, where he was writing, and he was an Oriental friend, and he had on the wall a portrait. Happened not to be this one, but let's say it was. And he was very, very proud of being the owner, and very proud of the handsome painting. And he asked his friend what he thought about it, and he said, "Well, it's all right." And Joyce Carey was a little piqued, and he wondered why. Why don't you get more enthusiastic? He knew the guy was a very sensitive person. And he said, "Well, why did Rembrandt paint that face dirty on one side?" And then it dawned on Carey, of course, that the perspective of visual training from which his friend came was not involved with the illusionism of roundness and volume. So that when we look at this portrait of Rembrandt, we talk of the eyes sunken in the head, of the face modeled in warm light, of the figure projecting from the ground and in and out of the warm brown background. But that's alien to, that's the way we're taught to see. We were not born to see that way. The Oriental, on the other hand, isn't interested in volume. To him, that's kind of nonsense. It's flat. It's a flat piece of paper or a flat piece of silk. Have a nice face on it. And that's it. The disturbing of that surface to make it illusionistic, to make it look not flat, is in general a characteristic that they're not interested in. Rich mentioned this one a couple of days ago in an eye-opener. Or maybe it was one of his night sessions. Illusionism, not only of objects in space, but of space itself. Until about the 5th century or 6th century in the West, we were heirs of illusionistic principles, that is, taking a flat surface and making it look, quote, real. That's why I don't use the term. Making it look natural, 3D. And then the interest waned. It wasn't because of an inability. It was simply a result of a focus and attention on something else for most of our Middle Ages. And then one of the great achievements that we give credit to the Renaissance, particularly the Italians, for, is the creation, not the discovery, of perspective. Masaccio did not walk down the street of Florence and, he picked up a rock and, wow, look what I found. Perspective. It is not a thing that was found. He discovered it, or he created it, by trying to make a relationship between his surface and what he identified as the extension of his own space. And on the right, if you look closely, you can see that this artist, Masaccio, has created a stage setting for us, an extension of our world, by understanding what happens to objects on our visual scheme of things back here someplace, as they recede in space, in a relationship between objects. You've all done this in school, where you draw your railroad track and then put some telephone poles along the side. You see how that goes in? How? I think it goes in. That's as close to me as that is. But it's a way, it's a trick, it's a device of having you get involved with relating objects to space. This is tied up partially with the rebirth of Platonic philosophy in the 15th century also, that talked about man's relationship to his space. But in the West, even when they, or in the East, when they tried to do a little bit of that, they didn't go whole hog. For example, the building in this Japanese woodcut, the roof line is parallel, the front and the back one. They don't come to a point. Let me go one step further and show you. Or in this very handsome silk painting of a bunch of young charmers are playing at a court. They're all playing separate musical instruments. They're seated at a table. Now, if you look at that table closely, what you find is the nearest edge is this dimension, and the back edge is bigger. So not only does the space not come to a point, as it does in Western perspective, but it gets bigger. Now, there's a very interesting way to look at this, you know, which is more true, which is real. If you were to walk down a railroad track, mostly, unless you're on some Amtrak trains I've been on, the tracks don't come together down there. There's no point down there. Fact is, when you get down there, you can see more than you saw from back here. It opens up. So, philosophically, the inversion of a spatial cone to make everything come to a point, philosophically, it's more true, more real, more valid to have this. I say philosophically because visually it's alien to the way we are trained. The point of this, in part, is then to identify for you further this idea that we are trained to see things that way. We're trained to see things this way, and that's why Joyce Carey's friend was not illiterate visually. He just came from another literacy. And his own training in the visual area was of a different order. And that's why when you have, oh, this is one of the great paintings. This is a man on a trip to Shu. It's the Emperor Ming Wang on a trip to Shu. And I'm sorry you can't see this. But in one sense, I'm not, because you're not supposed to see it all together. You ought to sneak up and take a peek. There's a little path coming through the mountains here, and horseback train with the emperor is following it. We look at that. There are some statements now of the illusionistic principle, but we're not going to get lost in that kind of a space. We're not going to have a phony statement of surface. Now, this doesn't mean they didn't think of it in terms of certain space. One of the stories of a similar painting is when the landscape illustrator, when he finished, he put his brush down and hopped up this path and went around the cliff and disappeared. We never saw him again. Now, the presence of the story indicates the realness that they felt when they got involved with their statement of reality. It's not based on the illusionistic principles or perspective that we have admired, rightly so, since the beginning of the 15th century. Perhaps the extreme end of this, if you compare these two works, is shown in this 15th century painting of the Flagellation of Christ. And if you look closely, you'll find the flagellation. This is the painting that was stolen, isn't it, Rich? Yeah. Yeah, wow, one of the monumental pieces of our life in the 15th century was stolen from the Ducal Palace in Urbino within the last 4 or 5 months, I guess. This shows the flagellation in the background. And there are drawings of the plan of this painting to indicate the tremendous interest that the artist had in space. Three figures in the foreground in conversation. In the background takes on the flagellation. Seated on the left is who? Maybe Pilate, maybe somebody else. It's up for grabs, the actual meaning of the painting. But one meaning of it you cannot deny, and that is a tremendous understanding of these figures right here. And then the architecture goes back, the floor pattern, a very intricate inlaid floor pattern, and then Christ on the cross way in the back. See? Well, I don't use too much those terms. When I talk about Orient, I don't talk about way in the back, this figure forward, the roundness of the volume. In general, illusionism in perspective or the creation of objects in space or their own fatness, illusionism is not really something that in general the Oriental has been particularly concerned with.
Let me talk a little bit about... Well, let's see what I want to do. Ideal feminine beauty. Yeah, nice topic.
Let's go back to this. We look at these, if you can look closely, you'll find they're pasty-faced, very pasty. Their face has been painted, in fact, and powdered to be the color and perhaps the texture of sheet of paper. Now, why? Why did they draw fat, flat people? I submit they drew them because that was their ideal form of feminine beauty. Now, for some of us, we're not turned on in any sensual way or any idealistic way with feminine beauty like that. But the Five Dynasty painter was. And he wasn't out on a limb. We have very few works of painting from that particular period, but those that are created this way do indicate that their ideal feminine form is a very heavy, not heavy, take it back. It's not heavy because you don't have any volume. It's more like a balloon, round-faced, big form. On the right, an ideal statement of beauty in, for most of Fashion Row in New York all the time, and for the 15th century in Italy with Botticelli. But we go a century and a half down the pike, and this is the ideal Western feminine form, particularly for a Flemish artist. Again, styles of the ideals change, so that this should not be any more foreign to us than perhaps Rubens.
What's the name of this?
This is part of a series of paintings celebrating the arrival of Marie de Medici, who came to marry Henry the Fourth, or Henry the Fifth, Fourth, I guess. And she was greeted at the port of Marseille with all kinds of festivities, including the gods and goddesses of the water, who gave her a safe trip from Italy to Marseille. Well, some kind of first principle can maybe come here. And I've said it before, I'll just repeat it, that most of us are, we see what and how we're trained to see. And we frequently see things which are not present except by our own projections. And basic concepts about life, basic concepts about manners, we project onto the image we see, therefore we say we see that. It can't be otherwise. We cannot get out of our own background to make a statement, but we can see that for a number of people, they project different manners and different characters, different qualities, and therefore their images are bound to be different. Those of you who saw the Nixon tour on TV, which I suspect everybody did, you remember the plays that they saw. Wow, they're totally incomprehensible to much of us in the West. The No play, for example, or the some of the Chinese opera. I do horrible in a Chinese opera because it's a social gathering. The hawkers come up and sell pop, and conversations are going on, and there's nothing that blows my own personal mind more than a disturbing element in an experience that's supposed not to have it. That's why I might as well let it all hang out. Why I really get hung up at Vespers when a little urchin is making noise. Now I realize that the urchin ought to hear the word. Oh, but I can't rationalize this. This is my own hang-up. But I really get disturbed when I got 12 kids running around or bat. Even if they're 1 and a half and they're just making nice cooing sounds, oh, I just freeze. And Cookie strokes me and says, relax, and it'll be all right. But the point is, the Chinese opera is like that because it's not all of a unit. Again, this fits exactly with the very first thing I stated about the sense of unity in Western art. Is a finality or a completeness, and it's kind of an exclusion a little bit with a frame or a time sequence or a stage with all the lights off every place, everybody lined up in a row. Don't you dare eat popcorn behind me while I'm listening to that guy. See? That, well, in the Western world, that's necessary, and that's my tradition. But in the Eastern world, they're freer about that. So take your kids and go to the Eastern world. Oh, I don't mean it. Well, you got to, I was taught to be truthful and all that.
By the same token, the preciousness of a work of art, and I don't know about this, I'm submitting an idea that I think about, but I'm not sure it's particularly true. The preciousness isn't of an individual piece is greater in the West. If you go to, go to Urbino, and you swipe that Piero della Francesca Resurrection, you've got Piero della Francesca's Resurrection. Wow! You know what would happen in the East? Three guys would show up tomorrow with three other copies, give it to the dealer, and he'd hang it on a wall. You can go, if you want to get a painting by Wang Wei, they say, well, fine, would you like a 17th century Wang Wei? How about a 19th century Wang Wei? It's like saying, do you want a Raphael? Got a great 19th century Raphael here. That kind of preciousness is a Western hang-up and is not present so much in the East. In drama, one of the great pieces of literature of all times, The Dream of the West Chamber, a magnificent piece that you all should read. But it's spasmodic. You can come in and out whenever you want. There's no sense of flow, no sense of unity in our tight kind of frame of reference. Now, on the other hand, on smaller pieces, but maybe that's our own hang-up, on smaller pieces, I'm not so sure. But again, I might be projecting my own 20th century experience onto these. We have great admiration for the Tang Dynasty horses. Some of them are huge like this, magnificent running blaze. Oh, beautiful. Anybody see the traveling Chinese show? One of the great, come on, you didn't. Of all people. We had a conversation about
that. There was
that.
A trade fair in Cologne that the Chinese put on, the first time they'd had
trade
one.
Fair?
Yeah, it was on in June of this year.
with commercial goods?
Yeah.
Well, they had it, but there's this traveling show I saw in Kansas City in April. It was in the East Coast, and it's going in one place on the West Coast. Maybe it's there now. Of the new archaeological discoveries? Yeah, from the People's Republic of China. When? Of what? All right, go. Everybody, oh, magnificent stuff. And you do have the opportunity then, if you haven't seen it at other museums, identify some preciousness from the Western point of view on individual pieces. For example, these nice Tang horses or an early Shang bronze. Again, remember something about our own perspective. One of the great pieces of feelings of admiration I have for the work on the right is based on that superior green. Oh, it just fluctuates greens. It's not green, it's greens and blues. And it's 120% phony. These things are bronze. When they were finished, they were highly polished, reflected light, brilliant, just like a mirror surface. What's happened over the age is a chemical change with the bronze, particularly the copper content of bronze, which has given us that nice green patina. It's made them very fragile and elegant. But you've got to shift gears, as I mentioned at the beginning a little bit, to make sure that you can admire this, admire it. It's a great joy, but don't then project your admiration onto the Shang bronze worker who made it and say, wow, he had a great eye for green. That is just a nonsense statement. Here's a comment by a writer on the I Ching. The I Ching is one of the earliest pieces of literature which the Chinese have accepted as a basis up until the People's Republic anyway. All my comments, by the way, you will recognize, are based on not on contemporary China because of their conscious effort to change these very traditions and in a sense get closer to the West. But the I Ching, one of the earliest writings accepted by the Chinese, we translate that as the Book of Changes. That might be a clue, too, that things are in fluctuation, things are in movement. You've got to relate to it where you are. You can't encapsulate it. You can't put a frame around it. You can't still it. These are one of the things I find with Eastern art as opposed to West. It itself claims, as upheld by Confucius, this is a quote, every occurrence in the tangible and visible world is only a symbol, an image of an abstract idea located in the invisible world. Events took place beyond man's sense perception. The author of this comment then
come to the conclusion that this is a rejection of causality in the Western sense of the world. Instead of cause and effect, the Chinese chose to study the coincidental relations between phenomena. Instead of a logical chain of mechanical causation, we have association between apparently most incongruous elements. Now, think of that for a moment, and we'll look at some examples. Let's look specifically at two or three areas of painting that we're familiar with. Landscape, for example. Both the East and the West, the use of landscape can be seen partly as a kind of escape from the cares of the world. And in many instances, some of the great landscape painters of our tradition came from a big city. Constable was one who was painting the work on the left screen. Claude Lorrain is painting the one on the right screen. It's called A Sermon on the Mount, but you have to look close to see the sermon, because what he's really talking about is this magnificent, magnificent landscape. We depict nature in the West as being under our spell. That is, we are in control of the landscape that you see here. And we're in control of it. The artist tells us that by some of the devices which I've talked about. Perspective, for example. The illusionistic statement of space, objects in space, the recession of planes as you move from the foreground action to the great middle ground action to the distance action. What the artist has done by doing it that way is to freeze it and put it under my control, my dominance. We can measure distances. We can place objects in this space in a very rational, controlled manner. Here's another one. Poussin, the great French classicist painter, whose landscape is really structured, it's created. To follow the kinds of simple rules, I'm oversimplifying, this is not all that's there obviously, but to follow the simple rules of man being the measure and man being in control. This is John on the island of Patmos, even puts John as Claude does on the right. As a kind of PS, I have a hard time with these two artists getting involved with what Rich calls the brass plaque on the bottom. I'm not drawn to John, nor am I drawn to the mount and the sermon. What I'm drawn to is this magnificent landscape, controlled, structured, presented to me as a kind of a finished piece. Even when we control it in a way that makes it like a hothouse, as Fragonard has done here, the subject of it is a series of four or five paintings now in the Frick Museum in New York of a typical Rococo 18th century theme of love and the chase. And this girl has taken refuge in the citadel, and the man is charging the citadel. That's the title of it, in fact. Well, heaven's sake, she's looking out of the corner of her eye to make sure she's situated just right as he comes over the rampart. But the whole thing is bathed in a hothouse of stuff that never grew in France, but it's structured in a way to control my experience of what's going on there, and therefore my control of the landscape itself. In contrast, we could go back to a couple of the paintings that we had. I won't bother to do that. Keep them in your mind. But in contrast, the landscape on the right, which is really very tiny, this is a real landscape. It's a dry landscape, so-called dry landscape in a Japanese garden at Daitokuji. The sand, the gravel, placed there not as a statement of man's control of nature, but that man can now participate in the experience and grow out into it. There's no water here, but you can, I can hear water. I can sense it's falling down this little path and over a stone, and there's no water there. The artist has created, with a great conscious effort, a possibility of my entering into the experience of the work. You go to some of the gardens in Japan, and there's a stream you have to cross, and there are seven rocks on the stream, and you notice that they're not, if you want to walk at a nice pace, they're not placed that way. They're placed three very close together, and one of them is very far apart. And the reason for that is, if you want to get over there and not dump yourself, you take the first three, then you've got to pause. If you keep going at the same pace, you'll end up in a drink. The reason for the pause, the reason for the control in this instance of the step of you, is that you will pause at that moment and look around. And it's at that point that they created a great view looking up the valley. My participation in it. And this I find one of the major differences between the landscape on the east and the west. That I'm in control in the west, and in the east I am part of. And even when they involve themselves with decorative screens in a late period, this is a Momoyama screen. I have a hard time relating to this in the same way that I relate to the Poussin, which is ordered and structured in a very rational, controlled way. The one on the right demands a movement of me, not an isolation at all. The human figure, certainly in terms of the nude, the West has it all over the East. There are really no nudes at all in Western art. They're not in Eastern art. They're not interested in that. We have been from classical times on through, with the great Apollo figure on the right, and a very young young maiden, a dedicatory piece of sculpture from Athens, about 6th century B.C. on the left. So the human figure has been a very strong part, played a big role in the evolution of Western art. In Eastern art, not so much, and when they are, they usually are involved with sages or the Buddha figure, and that's about all. Every once in a while, some personalities. There are some portraits, but they're almost anomalies in the evolution of the art. This is a Kuan Yin, a Buddha of mercy on the right. Compare that with the figure of Polycletus, a 5th century Greek sculptor on the left. The title of this will give you a clue about what Western man was doing at that time, anyway, and what we seem to have inherited. The title of this is the canon. That means the rule, the regulation, the order. All figures, the ideal, should be that high. The head is of such and such proportion, the finger of such and such, the thigh of such and such. Even Polycletus himself considered this to be a work of art that embodied the ideal of art in its own form. Boy, that is so circumscribed that it's impossible for me to find that in...
Well, that's not one of the classical positions of Buddha.
Yeah, that's one of the positions in late period of the mercy figure. It's very elegant. The comparable one in our period might be Boucher's Madame Kelly. Her name is Kelly? Something like that. Where's the Irishman? He just left to fix dinner. I'll see him later. As a result, eroticism as a public art form, as public as we can get in the Orient, is not a concern. They do have erotic art. We had an exhibit of much of it at Carlton a few years ago with a magnificent collection of Japanese woodcut prints. But it's not quite the public form that it has been. So the human figure even takes on a different flavor for the East, different from from in the West. There are some intriguing similarities now and then, but I'm not talking so much about generalities now as about individual pieces. This is a very quick, called a kind of a pomo splashed ink technique painting by Liang Kai of the poet Li Po, standing in standing in the ware. See, I can't do that. There is some interesting similarities with the technique that Rembrandt used, with just a handful of strokes with the figure on the right. They both have a quiet kind of air of meditation, contemplative nature. Though in this particular instance, I find a kind of similar relationship, although, again, Rembrandt could not help being Rembrandt, 17th century, and a figure had to be in space even though it was a sketch. So this wash in the background, see, I use that term, the wash in the background projects the figure forward. I got none of that here, none of that. The figure is timeless. It's kind of spaceless. That's another relationship with our medieval art, the timelessness of much of Oriental imagery, even when they're involved with figures and even when they're involved with historical characters. We know when Li Po lived. But the artist is not concerned with capturing that particular moment in time. You would never find this in the East. On the left, a series of paintings of the nude done by de Kooning and starting in the late 50s up into the 60s, a luscious pigment surface of excruciating forms. Or the strident social comment by Wesselman on the right about the nature of woman and how she is used. This is one of a series of paintings he calls The Great American Nude. He did a great number of them. And what he's done, of course, is to take a female form and make it an object. And, of course, that's what he's trying to say. So I find this to be a very sharp social comment about the handling of people by people.